Hey folks, this is Scott Weingart and you're listening to the MCrit podcast. Today, we're going to discuss a concept called driving pressure. And this is based on an article published last year in the New England Journal entitled Driving Pressure and Survival in the Acute Respiratory Distress Syndrome. It was by Marcello Amato et al. And it was a very intriguing paper because what it said is that this measure called driving pressure, which is tidal volume of the breaths the patient's receiving divided by the compliance of their respiratory system, may be a better predictor of survival than what we were using formerly, which was things like the plateau pressure. And this was a retrospective study, so it's not definitive, but it was a retrospective study done on individual patient data. So they actually went back, got the data for each individual patient and looked at it, as opposed to meta-analyzing studies as a whole. So this is potentially interesting. And I've been batting back and forth using these ideas in my clinical practice since the publication of the article. And I think that now it deserves a full podcast treatment, especially because there was an amazing lecture by the senior author of the paper, one Roy Brower, on the Maryland CC project. And we'll have that linked in the show notes of this episode. Roy Brower is a professor of medicine and the medical director of the MICU at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in Maryland. He has extensive publications and a real focus on ARDS. So he's the perfect person to talk to about this. We're going to go into some of the logistics and real like hands-on stuff, as you'd expect on an MCRIT podcast. If you're interested in hearing more of the theory and the basis for all this, then you should listen to that Maryland CC Project lecture I'll have linked. So driving pressure, I mentioned, is tidal volume divided by respiratory system compliance. And this is interesting because driving pressure also, in a patient who's not spontaneously breathing, is the plateau pressure measured by an inspiratory pause on the ventilator minus the PEEP. And it's both of these things at the same time. And if you can't really wrap your head around that, then there's a picture in the show notes that I think will explain it very well. But it's both of those. It's tidal volume over respiratory system compliance and also plateau minus PEEP. And therefore, because of the latter, it can be measured at the bedside relatively easily because you already should be measuring plateau pressures to make sure it's less than 30. And now if you just subtract the PEEP, you'll get your driving pressure. And the driving pressure inflection point from the study seems to be less than 15, good, greater than or equal to 15, potentially bad. And the article goes so far as to say that even in patients with a plateau pressure greater than 30, if the driving pressure is less than 15, those patients are still safe. And in a patient with a plateau of less than 30, with a driving pressure greater than or equal to 15, potentially injurious, and you may want to take action. So really intriguing. And if you go further into it, it may explain why some of the studies we expected to be positive, like the high PEEP trials, and you guys know if you've been listening to MCRIT for any length of time that I am a lover of the higher PEEP tables and the higher PEEP strategies for acute lung injury rather than the lower PEEP ones that have become commonplace. But it may explain why they didn't work, because if you're elevating the PEEP and the driving pressure is getting worse, then that was useless. But if you increase the PEEP, manage to recruit more lung, and therefore you make your driving pressure less, therefore you make the compliance of the respiratory system better by recruiting lung, then the higher PEEP will be more effective for these patients and will potentially lead to better survival. So I love this driving pressure concept because it explains a lot of the things I've had trouble with and presents a real bedside strategy for optimizing these patients, for making decisions like going below 6 mLs per kg ideal body weight, for decisions about whether increasing PEEP is good or bad. Let's get right into the interview with Dr. Roy Brower, and then put all your questions in the webpage for this show, and then I'm going to do a follow-up episode, potentially with the first author, Dr. Amato, and we can answer all your questions as we go through them. All right, Roy Brower on driving pressure. The question we will start with is driving pressure ready for prime time clinical use, or is it still something that needs further verification?
That's a good question. I don't think it's ready for prime time routine use because, first, the most direct way to reduce driving pressure, which is an interesting goal, is to reduce tidal volume. There's no question that if you reduce tidal volume, the driving pressure will decrease. The problem is that we really don't have sufficient data to say that reducing driving pressure with lower tidal volumes, especially lower than our current target of 6 milliliters per kilogram predicted body weight, can be tolerated. If we reduce tidal volumes below 6, there is almost always some hypercapnia and acidosis. In fact, even at 6 milliliters per kilogram, there's frequently hypercapnia and acidosis. But there have been no studies to say that we should target lower tidal volumes for the purpose of having lower driving pressures. For that matter, I don't think we're ready to target lower tidal volumes for that purpose. On the other hand, in some patients, the driving pressures are quite high, and those patients are in trouble. And so in some of those patients, perhaps we should be a little more aggressive in lowering tidal volume in order to get the driving pressure under control.
Now, in the lecture from the Maryland CC Project, which we'll put in the show notes, you did talk about how driving pressure informs your clinical practice, and I'd love to delve into that if you're okay with it.
Okay.
So you get just admitted to your unit, fresh from the emergency department, a patient with intrapulmonary ARDS secondary to bilateral pneumonia, and they had the patient on 8 cc's per kg, ideal body weight, and he's currently on 10 of PEEP and 50% FiO2. How do you manage this patient in the vein of using driving pressure?
All right. Did I hear you right? When you did you say the patient is on 8 cc's per
yep,
kilogram?
Yep, and I said that deliberately because I want to understand if you're first checking the driving pressure, if you're empirically lowering the tidal volume to 6 and then using driving pressure. What is the first manipulation you make?
I would probably reduce the tidal volume to 7 and then down to 6 milliliters per kilogram predicted body weight as just to start. And I would do it in steps to see how the patient is tolerating it. You know, is he becoming tachycardic, tachypneic, hypertensive, diaphoretic? And I would check a blood gas at a tidal volume of 6 unless the oxygenation on the pulse oximetry is very good and there are no other clinical signs of poor tolerance. Once I got to 6 milliliters per kilogram, I would measure a plateau pressure. And if the plateau pressure is below 30, then I would probably stay at 6 milliliters per kilogram. On the other hand, if the plateau pressure is above 30, I'd probably lower the tidal volume a little bit more. At some point, though, if we're at 6 milliliters per kilogram, and especially if the plateau pressure is above 30, that means his driving pressure is high. You know, if the plateau pressure is 32 and his PEEP is 10, then his driving pressure is 22, and that's quite high. You know, taking all comers in that study in the New England Journal on driving pressure last year, the average driving pressure was about 14 or 15 centimeters of water. So if it's as high as 22, this patient is in trouble, probably in trouble. Depends on whether the plateau and the driving pressures are high because of lung disease or chest wall disease. Assuming it's lung disease, and 22 is very high, and I would be aggressive in lowering the tidal volume.
Okay, so you're going to take him from 6 down to 5?
If the plateau pressure is above 30 and his driving pressure is above 14 or 15, I would go lower on the tidal volume. Another thing I would do is at a PEEP of 10, I would adjust the PEEP upwards by about 4 centimeters of water and see if the driving pressure increases or decreases or stays the same. This is a way of customizing PEEP to an individual in relation to his recruitability or his tendency to over-distend. If I leave the tidal volume at 6 milliliters per kilogram or 5, wherever we've settled in on the tidal volume, and then raise the PEEP from 10 to 14, if the plateau goes up less than 4, then the driving pressure has decreased. And that suggests to me that the patient has recruited and he's better off at 14 than 10. I might go higher on the PEEP, depending on the initial response with respect to the driving pressure.
So this is one of the questions that came up is, so you're already at 6 now, and you notice that the driving pressure is the 22 we were talking about. Which one would you do first? Would you consider the decrease in tidal volume, or would you consider the incremental increases in PEEP?
I would reduce the tidal volume. I'd be doing some other things as well. I'd probably turn this patient prone, you know, because proning in some patients is a good recruitment maneuver. If we can get more aerated lung accepting part of the tidal volume, then the driving pressure will decrease.
Sure. When would you stop? Would you keep going as long as the driving pressure continues to decrease?
I probably would, but I probably would not let the plateau pressure get above 35. You know, that study in New England, it suggests that plateau pressure is not the issue if you know driving pressure. In other words, a plateau pressure above 30 with the driving pressure that's decreasing because we increase the PEEP, that means the patient's probably better off, less ventilator-induced lung injury. But I wouldn't let the plateau pressure go above 35 because we're just not in an environment yet where we have sufficient data to push limits beyond that.
What's the lowest you'd go on the tidal volume?
Depends on how well the patient is tolerating it. I had a patient several months ago in whom we went as low as 3 milliliters per kilogram because as we did this and we turned him prone and we gave him a neuromuscular blocking agent, his lungs started opening up and they were more efficient and CO2 retention and acidosis weren't so severe. So we went as low as 3 milliliters per kilogram to get his driving pressure into a range we were more comfortable with.
Makes complete sense. So then what do you do for these profound hypercapnias? Tham is now off the market. I'm not sure if bicarb has any true efficacy. Are you just letting them ride with very low pHs?
We may put a limit on how low we'll go on tidal volume if we think hypercapnia and acidosis is a problem. But we'll allow some pretty substantial CO2 retention with acidosis. You know, if a patient is tolerating it hemodynamically, with a blood pressure that's not sky high and a heart rate that's not very high, and other organs are not showing signs of feeling the effects, then we'll let pH fall well below 7.2. And we've tolerated PCO2s over 100 for the purpose of lung protection. You know, in Keith Hickling's reports, this goes back, I think, to the late 80s or early 90s, where he's introducing the idea of using lower tidal volumes to prevent ventilator-induced lung injury. He reports some patients with PCO2s well over 100 who survived with, you know, very low pHs. So I'm not trivializing this. I think there can be some problems with severe acidosis, but generally, if we can protect the lungs, it's worth doing this for a little while.
Absolutely. One of the questions that came up is, should we be doing a recruitment maneuver to get a more rapid picture of whether there's recruitable lung units or not?
Well, the maneuver I mentioned a few minutes ago where we raise PEEP and see the response in the driving pressure, I mean that gives us useful information about whether a patient has potential to recruit. I'm not enamored by recruitment maneuvers. I think you can, in some patients, you can recruit some lung, but unless you paralyze the patients, I think the recruitment maneuver effect is short-lived. A few coughs and the patient will de-recruit and you'll lose the effect of that recruitment maneuver. And even with neuromuscular blockade, I'm not convinced that the effects of recruitment maneuvers are lasting. So I'll use a recruitment maneuver if I think a patient has experienced a de-recruitment maneuver and arterial oxygenation is not recovering to where it was before. A de-recruitment maneuver, for example, could be an inadvertent disconnection from the ventilator in a patient who's on PEEP. That patient may desaturate quickly. And if that patient does not recover within a few minutes, I may do a recruitment maneuver.
That makes sense. That's
pretty much the only circumstance when I do recruitment maneuvers.
Hey folks, Weingart popping in here. I think after that discussion, I need to do an entire show on recruitment maneuvers because I have some slightly different ideas about them, especially as an embracer of the open lung strategy and ways to prevent that de-recruitment after you successfully have recruited. So we'll do that. But Dr. Brower's comments are dead on. A lot of patients won't respond to a recruitment maneuver, and sometimes even the ones that do, if you do not protect the alveoli you just recruited, they may de-recruit, and that may actually lead them to be worse than they were before the recruitment maneuver. So one of the most important parts of calculating the driving pressure at the bedside is getting an accurate plateau pressure measurement. And there's many different ways of obtaining this depending on the ventilator and the individual clinician preference. What is your means of obtaining an accurate plateau pressure?
Well, we'll measure the plateau pressure in triplicate. And if the three measures are within a couple centimeters of each other, then we have some confidence that we're getting good plateau pressures. Another very important thing to do is look at the airway pressure versus time relationship on the ventilator screen during the recruitment maneuver. During the measurement of plateau pressure. I like to see a good plateau. If instead the pressure comes down as if it's trying to plateau, but then it starts to go up, that probably means the patient is contracting the abdominal muscles trying to get air out during the inspiratory pause. Another effect you may see is if a plateau pressure is approached, but then the patient makes an inspiratory effort and the airway pressure goes down. So you have to look at the screen to make sure you're seeing a reasonable plateau.
Absolutely. And are you taking the number the vent gives you, or are you just looking on the pressure time waveform?
Both.
Okay.
But they're pretty close.
Yep.
I usually take the number that the ventilator reports if it's a good plateau.
Now, the original article in the New England, it excluded patients with spontaneous breathing. Is that because of inaccurate plateau measurements, or is there some other reason?
No, it's for that reason.
Okay. So if you had a spontaneously breathing patient, but you were able to obtain plateaus, then this is still applicable.
I think so.
So just as we're finishing up here in the last couple minutes, let me just ask you in general some of your practices on patients with potential for acute lung injury due to critical illness, but not yet ARDS. Do you manage them the same way? Are you using these same ultra-low tidal volumes? Are you using driving pressure in these patients?
So let me make sure I got the question right. Patients who don't yet meet the criteria for ARDS, but they're at risk.
Yeah, or let's say they're solely at risk because of any patient with critical illness being at risk for acute lung injury. But right now, they are not showing pulmonary issues. Right. How do you manage, in general and with or without driving pressure, these patients in your unit?
Well, I probably don't use driving pressure unless the airway pressures are surprisingly high. But let's imagine, for example, a patient who's septic, perhaps from abdominal sepsis, but his chest x-ray does not show a lot of opacifications. That patient is at substantial risk of getting ARDS, and I would use a lung protective approach in this patient. I would aim to get the tidal volume down to 6 milliliters per kilogram predicted.
Very good. And then you'd just be measuring plateaus, and only if the plateaus started creeping up would driving pressure enter into the mix?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
All right. I guess the final question I'll ask you is, what's the one thing you see screwed up on patients with ARDS most, and how would you like it remedied?
Well, I think most intensive care docs agree that they should use a lung protective approach. And if asked, do you use the target of 6 milliliters per kilogram? Many will say yes. The problem is frequently they're at 7, 8, or 9 milliliters per kilogram, which is better than 10, 11, or 12 milliliters per kilogram, which is what we had 10 or 15 years ago. You know, I don't think you have to be at 6 in order to say you've adjusted your ventilator approach to be more lung protective. But we have good reason to think that 8 is not as good as 7, and 7 is not as good as 6. So I think in order to be as rigorous with lung protection as we can, I think docs should aim to get to 6. And that means getting a good measure of body height, getting a good calculation of predicted body weight, and setting the tidal volume according to that.
All right. Well, I can't thank you enough for your time, sir. And this will be a great help to the listeners.
You're welcome.